Hi, I'm Gail with Virginia Voice. Welcome to our reading of VPM News at vpm.org. Today's first article, Richmond Sets Youth Curfew Amid Spate of Gun Violence, is by Megan Moore and Donthea M. Price Lisco, April 16, 2024. Richmond officials are responding to the recent increase in gun violence affecting city school students by implementing a curfew for minors. Between March 31st and Monday, 8 people in Richmond have been shot, and 4 of those who died were public school students, according to Richmond Police Chief Rick Edwards. Edwards identified a through line in the recent violence. The common theme in these murders are simple arguments that have escalated into gunfire. Taking a gun to an argument may make you feel safer, but it doesn't make you safer. In some of these cases, adults have tried to intervene. In some of these cases, adults have exacerbated the situation. He was flanked by Mayor LeVar Stoney, Richmond Public School Superintendent Jason Camras, and members of City Council. Camras opened his own remarks by identifying each of the RPS facilities impacted by recent shootings. Bellevue and Chimborazo Elementary Schools, Martin Luther King Middle School, Armstrong and Thomas Jefferson High Schools, and Richmond Alternative School. He said, 169 minors have been shot in Richmond since 2019, and nearly all of those were RPS students. That level of gun violence, he continued, has had a profound effect on the Richmond Public Schools community. Think about the impact that has across friends and family members and teachers, our community, our schools. They are hurting, and they should be focused on the SOLs, which were given in 2 weeks, Camras said. Instead, many of them this morning and last week and tomorrow are holding grief sessions, because that's what we do. We will always stand in the gap for our kids. The Richmond Times-Dispatch has reported on recent gun violence in a variety of city neighborhoods, including stories on the deaths of a 14-year-old who was shot March 31st in North Highland Park, a 16-year-old who was shot and killed in Wickham Court on April 10th, and another 16-year-old who was shot Sunday on St. John Street. In a separate incident on April 11th, a 17-year-old was injured in a shooting that left 2 people dead at Mosby Court. The bullets tear not only through bodies, but also through the connective tissue of our communities, Camras wrote in an email bulletin sent Monday to RPS families. With each wound, our neighborhoods and the social bonds that strengthen them become even more stressed. Many are at the breaking point. The Richmond Police Department on Monday announced several strategies to combat the recent uptick in gun violence. This past weekend, Edwards called in the department's property crimes personnel, as well as detectives, and put them in uniforms and unmarked police cars to patrol public safety hotspots. I've also asked the area Virginia State Police to come in this week and start assisting us. They're focusing on our 21 hottest spots in Richmond, and they'll be doing that all week, Edwards said Monday. In conjunction with the school division, RPD will also provide security and extra police presence at school pickup and drop-off locations. Edwards said the department would be particularly focusing on the East End schools. The department also announced that in response to the violence, Operation Safe Summer will be restarted Friday instead of waiting until later in the year. The program was first launched last summer, and as a result, RPD said it saw a 30% reduction in gun violence. For the initiative, the department has partnered with Virginia State Police, the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, the FBI, the United States Attorney's Office, and the local Commonwealth's Attorney. City officials asked parents to keep their children at home in the evenings. The new curfew, which runs 11 p.m. through 5 a.m., was put in place beginning Monday for Richmond's youth. It will run until further notice. Penalties for noncompliance weren't discussed. In addition to the curfew and increased security presence, RPD has set up an anonymous tip line to report illegal firearms. I know there are challenges out there. It's hard to meet the rent, put food on the table. But the top responsibility of parenthood is to care for your child no matter where they are, what time of day it is, Stoney said. After 11 o'clock, I want our parents and our guardians to ask, where are our children? Where are our children? Last year, VPM News spoke with Angela Jones, the Director of Culture, Climate, and Student Services at RPS. The conversation, How Richmond Public Schools Responds When Gun Violence Affects Students, focused on ways the division responds to gun violence in the community. A number of other resources are available to help families in the area. In 2022, VPM News published the Another Way, How One Virginia City Reckons with Gun Violence series. It includes a list of resources designed to help those who've been affected by gun violence, as well as how to prevent youth from becoming involved with guns. This article was by Megan Moore and Donthea M. Price Lisco. The next VPM News article, Restorative Program Needs Change Through Baking, is by Kiris Manzanares, April 18, 2024. The women at House of Bread are rising together. In 2017, the nonprofit started breaking down barriers to employment and stability for formerly incarcerated women in Roanoke. Since then, it's expanded to include under-resourced women in the area as well. Lisa Goad, House of Bread program coordinator and co-founder, said women from all backgrounds can benefit from what the organization has to offer. During the six-week program, women learn job and personal skills through baking while receiving emotional and spiritual support from mentors. They also reintegrate into the community by selling bread they've made alongside volunteers at pop-up events. When women come out of incarceration, we expect them to jump back into the community, get a job, find a place to live, and just be a part of the community. But we make that really hard because there's all these barriers, Goad explained. So taking down those barriers really helps us. It helps the women to be able to integrate better into the community. On baking days, the program operates out of the Leap Kitchen, a shared commercial kitchen and food business incubator near downtown Roanoke, run by nonprofit Local Environmental Agriculture Project. Heart-shaped cinnamon rolls, cheesy bread, chocolate chip cookies, and other confections have been on the menu. The act of baking can build community, and women in the class connect with volunteers and mentors who they might not have met otherwise. Susan Kessler has been volunteering with the organization since its inception. Kessler's a passionate baker who said the students impress her every time they come to the kitchen, though most have little to no baking experience. I've learned from these ladies. Some of them come with a lot of experience and some do not. So it's just kind of fun to sit back and see how much they want to know and what they want to do, Kessler said. I think the gratification of working really hard to make something together, and then when you see the bread come out of the oven, there's excitement on their faces. They can't believe they made that. Virginia Anderson is one of those women. I have been addicted to drugs for many years, and I finally went to treatment. I have 141 days clean, Anderson said. Because of the drug use, I had been in jail before, which made me eligible for this program. Anderson said when she comes to House of Bread, she leaves the world's stressors at the door. It helps me to be present in the moment. It gives me a sense of purpose and satisfaction, Anderson said about working in the kitchen. I'm good about paying attention to detail, and it's just very helpful to give me that time just to my own thoughts. As part of the program, women also take classes to obtain a food handling ServSafe certification, a qualification useful in the restaurant industry. It's been good because they've helped us build a resume and work on interviewing skills, Anderson said. It's also just been really therapeutic to get to work with the bread and just start with raw ingredients and then end up with the final product. Even with those skills, settling back into life after serving jail or prison time can be difficult. I think when a woman comes out of incarceration, she has made a mistake. And she has served the sentence, said Goad, the program co-founder. When she gets out, that's not the end of the sentence because there are stereotypes, barriers, and labels. And you cannot be restored to the community if the community sees you as a felon or as a junkie. You need that community to see you as a human being. This article was by Kiris Manzanares. Another VPM News article, Lynchburg City Schools Turns Suspensions into Solutions, by Kiris Manzanares, April 17, 2024. When Lynchburg City Schools students enter the Restorative Suspension Center, they know expectations are high. For the past year, the school division has taken a new approach to discipline. Typically, when a student is suspended, they're sent home. But LCS said students now serve suspensions at RSC, inside the Amelia Pride House, next to Dunbar Middle School for Innovation. 80% of the time, when a student comes to the Restorative Suspension Center, they don't return. So, that's much better than the 60% that we were seeing that were continuing to get suspended, said Derek Brown, LCS Director of Student Services. Only 10% of the time, students are returning for the same offense, whereas before, they were being suspended over and over again for the same behaviors and the same referrals. RSC opened in February 2023 as part of LCS Restore, holistic programming designed to empower students to succeed academically and emotionally through restorative practices. At RSC, students are engaged in all-day programming that helps them complete their classwork so they don't fall behind their cohort in traditional classrooms. The center also focuses on resolving conflict, repairing harm, and healing relationships. Every morning, Robert Sandifer, a restorative interventionist at LCS, sets the tone in his classroom by playing relaxing music, greeting each student, and enforcing a cell phone-free policy. Sandifer is a Lynchburg native who's had experiences similar to many of his students. "I got suspended, I came from a broken home and everything," Sandifer said. "I always tell them that you can use your past as an anchor to weigh you down the rest of your life, or you can use it as stepping stones." Jarrett Martin, the center's coordinator, frequently leads students in a circle, a fundamental tool in restorative practices. They serve as structured forms of dialogue and promote healing and conflict resolution. "I think these restorative practices are going back to baseline respect, accountability, and just being a good, productive citizen to make the world a better place," Martin said. In the circle, Martin sets boundaries and guidelines that can be applied to the classroom and home life balance. He then works with students to develop a game plan for when they return to their base school. Some students just want you to do small check-ins with them and bring them treats or rewards because they've been doing so well, Martin said. "Sometimes we do a 21-day challenge where we reward the student for being present for 21 days and working on some habits that they may need to break." The school system has also partnered with a Danville Human Services organization, Life Push, that comes to the Restorative Center each day to hold group sessions. Life Push uses its five phases of human engagement, which aims to facilitate supportive and effective conversations. Brown said the program's success stems from its holding students accountable, while also imparting an important message. "We don't just throw them away. It's important for them to be restored and for them to have people that care about them. They need to know that when they make a mistake or they mess up, it doesn't mean that they're a bad student," Martin said. "It just means that they made a mistake. And we're all humans. We make mistakes. But we should always grow from those mistakes, and we should learn, and we should get better." Lynchburg City Schools is planning to expand its restorative programs, which are funded through $10 million in federal and state grants, according to a school spokesperson. Aside from the Restorative Suspension Center, it has academies focused on holistic growth by providing intensive behavior intervention and social-emotional learning for elementary and secondary students. This article was by Kiris Manzanares. The next VPM News article, New Safety Rules on Silica Dust Aim to Protect Minors' Lungs, is by Howard Burks and Justin Hicks, April 16, 2024. On Tuesday, federal officials posted new rules to protect coal and other miners from toxic silica dust, a growing problem in mines that has left thousands sick and dying. It took mine safety regulators 50 years to do what federal researchers had long urged, make the exposure limit to silica dust twice as restrictive as currently allowed, and directly regulate exposure so citations and fines are possible when miners are overexposed. The new regulation also imposes for miners the same silica exposure limits that already apply to all other workers in the United States. No miner should ever have to sacrifice their health or lungs in order to provide for their family, said Chris Williamson, the Assistant Secretary of Labor for Mine Safety and Health. The Mine Safety and Health Administration acted after joint investigative reporting by NPR, Ohio Valley Resource, Public Health Watch, Mountain State Spotlight, and Louisville Public Media exposed a once-hidden epidemic of severe, incurable, and fatal black lung disease. Thousands of cases of disease among younger and younger miners. Thousands of instances of ongoing overexposure to silica dust, and decades of failure to respond. It is unconscionable that our nation's miners have worked without adequate protection from silica dust, despite it being a known health hazard for decades, Acting Secretary of Labor Julie Sue said in a prepared statement. MSHA revealed key elements of the regulation Monday night and published the full text of the final rule in the Federal Register on Tuesday morning just before a news conference. The new regulation requires mining companies to monitor the air miners breathe while working and adjust working conditions when excess silica dust is present. Instances of overexposure must be reported to MSHA, a requirement that was not in a regulation initially proposed last year, but was inserted after the news organization's reporting and complaints from mine safety advocates. The agency also makes a slightly stronger case for action. The proposed regulation failed to take into account the thousands of cases of severe or complicated black lung that have already occurred. The joint investigations by NPR, Public Health Watch, and their partners documented more than 4,000 cases of disease since 2010 and hundreds of deaths. But the agency predicted the new regulation would prevent only 244 cases of disease and 63 deaths of coal miners over 60 years. A strong case for stricter regulation is critical given possible industry and congressional opposition. The final regulation explicitly excludes the cases reported by black lung clinics and cited in our investigative reporting. Newer data from black lung clinics can provide suggestive evidence of the risks, but because it is not yet incorporated into peer-reviewed risk models, it cannot be included in this analysis, the rule reads. So for coal mines, the agency says the new regulation will prevent 325 cases of disease and 85 deaths. This is a critical step to keeping miners safe and healthy, not just day-to-day, but for their full lifetime, said Cecil Roberts, International President of the United Mine Workers of America. Now, our focus shifts to holding mining companies accountable. Silica is one of Earth's most abundant minerals, and it's about 20 times more toxic than coal dust. It's typical in the quartz that surrounds coal seams, especially in central Appalachia. Mining companies are being given time to adapt to the regulatory changes. Coal mines have a year to prepare. All other mines, collectively known as metal nonmetal mines, M&M, have 2 years. That's because the regulation imposes requirements that have never existed for M&M mines, including a health surveillance program with free periodic exams to detect early stages of silica-caused lung disease. The results of those exams must be reported to the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, which has monitored the health of coal miners for decades. M&M mines will also be required to do more dust sampling. Both that and the medical surveillance program will require extensive and costly additions to the mining process. That could trigger challenges. The new regulation is a monumental shift for MSHA, which identified a cluster of silica-caused black lung disease in 1996 and warned the mining industry about overexposure, but failed to impose new requirements. Agency officials at the time blamed industry opposition. "It's a good rule," said Vonda Robinson, vice president of the National Black Lung Association. But she said she's disappointed that most of the dust monitoring will be conducted by mining companies and not federal mine inspectors. "The coal operators should not do the testing," Robinson said in an interview. "I simply do not trust them." MSHA inspectors will monitor mine air for toxic dust during quarterly inspections, but that's only 4 times a year. If the mines have to play a part in it, let them play a small part, but not the critical part, said Debbie Johnson, a nurse at a black lung clinic in West Virginia whose husband suffers from the advanced stages of disease. "That should be done by MSHA. So our government needs to give MSHA some more money so they can get some people out there." MSHA's resources are already strained, and Congress denied a $50 million budget increase for more mine inspections and more silica dust sampling. Some Republicans in Congress have already tried to prohibit MSHA spending for implementation of the silica dust regulation. The National Mining Association welcomed one key element of the new regulation. "We fully support the new lower silica dust limits contained in the rule and are committed to working to improve the health and safety of our miners," said Ashley Burke, the association's spokeswoman. Burke was reluctant to say more Monday night since the full text of the new regulation had yet to be released. Robinson has watched her husband suffer from black lung disease. She suggested the stakes are high for miners in MSHA's attempt to finally get tough on silica dust. "The miners need to have a healthy life mining coal," she said, "and not leave their family at a young age from dying from black lung disease and silica." This article was by Howard Burks and Justin Hicks. Howard Burks is a member of the Public Health Watch Board of Directors. Burks is a former NPR investigations correspondent who collaborated with PBS Frontline on a landmark 2018 investigation exposing an epidemic of advanced black lung disease and the failure of federal regulators to prevent it. Justin Hicks is a data reporter for Louisville Public Media. Alan Siegler of Mountain State Spotlight contributed to this story. The next VPM news story: Richmond Housing Authority pauses evictions for at least 30 days, is by Patrick Larson, April 19, 2024. The Richmond Redevelopment and Housing Authority announced a new approach to lease enforcement amid public outcry over eviction cases it recently filed against residents. CEO Stephen Nesmith said the Compassion Action Initiative will focus on reestablishing relationships with residents, adhering to U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development regulations, strengthening data collection and sharing with stakeholders, and addressing a $3 million backlog of unpaid rent. At least 14 pending cases were dismissed from Richmond General District Court on Wednesday in a pause that Nesmith said would extend for a minimum of 30 days. RRHA said between 10 and 200 eviction proceedings have been initiated since the start of March and confirmed that any remaining on court dockets will be dismissed. "Our lease enforcement pause was done in part due to my wanting to triple-check our calculations to ensure that rents are properly calculated," Nesmith said at a Friday press conference. Michael Ross, an attorney with Legal Aid Justice Center, said on Wednesday that the dismissals are a step in the right direction, but added RRHA should do more to keep residents housed. This really matters right now because rent in Richmond has skyrocketed, Ross said. We have a significant shortage of rental housing units, and families who are evicted from RRHA face few, if any, choices of housing. Details of the initiative are not yet finalized, and the plan must be reviewed by RRHA's Board of Commissioners before being implemented. Prior to the announcement, RRHA and its leadership faced questions from city councilors and housing advocates about their accounting on past due balances and whether they have up-to-date info on residents' income, which is used in monthly rent and repayment plan calculations. At a City Council Education and Human Resources Committee meeting on Monday, Councilor Stephanie Lynch was one of those questioning the calculations. She said two residents recently told her about having a case filed against them and claimed their income was not up to date with RRHA, despite efforts to get in touch with the authority. A recent HUD audit on a random sample of 35 RRHA tenant files found errors in 66% of them. In response, RRHA requested confirmation of which files were said to contain errors. We weren't provided those files to confirm whether it was actually a miscalculation or whether there was a misunderstanding, said Kenyatta Green, RRHA Senior Vice President of Affordable Housing, at the Friday press conference. The authority defended its calculations, saying it's working to review ledgers with residents, council members, and advocacy groups. Lynch told VPM News she wants to secure a right to counsel for people facing evictions, and noted $500,000 in Mayor LeVar Stoney's proposed budget would establish a program for Richmonders in eviction court through the Public Defender's Office. RRHA officials did not rule out the possibility of receiving funds from City Council or selling undeveloped properties to cover the $3 million rent backlog. We're actually thinking out of the box on a number of ways to deal with the problem, said Nesmith. The Compassion Action Initiative will likely be presented at RRHA's next Board of Commissioners meeting on May 15, or during its June meeting. This article was by Patrick Larson, VPM News Environment and Energy reporter and fill-in host. Other VPM local news headlines this week. Auditor says 38% of Richmond restaurants were late on meals tax payments. After push from residents, part of former Lambert's Point golf course opens to public. Work on Lake Overton to address environmental issues, add walking trail. HRBT expansion marks breakthrough as boring machine completes first new tunnel. After a five-month U-turn, the monster drill will bore a second tunnel back to Norfolk. Legislators, governor, break budget deadlock, extend negotiations. The House exercised an arcane constitutional maneuver to prevent a full budget veto. State budget deal uncertain ahead of reconvened session. Amendments on guns, abortion, and environment will also be reviewed by lawmakers. Supreme Court gives some military veterans more generous educational benefits. Police reform may expand in Virginia, but behind closed doors. The new law has drawn criticism from open government groups. That's all for VPM News today. Thank you for listening. This program is also available anytime on demand at www.virginiavoice.org.